you for listening to the Cause and Effect podcast. My name is Nolan Bicknell, and I'm now joined in studios at the CJNU studios downtown Winnipeg, heart of Portage in Maine, by Stephanie Scott, the executive director of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So last week, we just announced the $5 million initial gift to the NCTR for this new opening of the, you're going to get a new building put together. Incredible announcement, incredible event. We'll talk about that in a couple seconds, but just to give people a little bit of context about the NCTR, give us a little bit of history. How did this all come to be? Where did it start? How did you get involved? Give us the whole backstory to start.
Sure. So the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation was born out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, one of the largest class action lawsuits in its history, survivor-based. And in 2015, the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation opened its doors. It was a very, very small staff. There was a former director, Ryan Moran, who led the team. He had about three people. The NCTR has continued to grow and evolve. Pre-COVID, we had 19 staff with us. And now, in these days, we have approaching 60 staff. So we have exploded in regard to our growth. We do research. We do public education. We work very, very closely with survivors. Survivor Circle is part of our governance structure. Mm-hmm. We also have a governing circle as well, and it is not only survivor-led, but First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, very distinction-based. And we continue to do the work and incorporate them every day in everything that we do.
That was the most powerful part of that event on Thursday, the kickoff event, was hearing from all the survivors, hearing their various perspectives. You've been hearing survivor perspectives probably your entire life. Does it ever, you know, is it magical and powerful every time?
It's magical and it's powerful. It's moving. It's emotional. I am the daughter of a Indian residential school survivor. I am also a 60 scoop survivor. I was taken away at birth. And so everything that I do and the work that I do every day is because I'm repairing, I'm learning, I'm understanding. And there's no greater gift in the world than to work with survivors who have led and lived and survived this journey. So I began working, I have a history of about 30 years in film and television, and I've always provided a foundation for Indigenous people to share their stories, amplify their truths, their oral histories. Back when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was underway, I started there. I was the manager of statement gatherings. Wow. So I have been all across this land, in every corner, from coast to coast to coast, and I've sat with survivors, I've sat with elders, and I've sat with knowledge keepers. And I can tell you that over the course of those years, the intensity and the emotion and the pain and the wailing that I heard was very instrumental for me in leading the way and knowing that I had been put on a journey that was the right path, because I was there not only to learn myself, but to help amplify the truth of those survivors.
It's, yeah, just constantly re-traumatizing yourself and for them to re-traumatize themselves. I think about a lot of times interviewing survivors or talking to people from that world, and like, I don't want to, a lot of times people are like, oh, tell us more, you know, like the burden of these stories and re-traumatizing people. I'm very trying to be conscious of like, you don't want to do that. But then also balancing, these stories need to be told, the names need to be said, the stories need to be preserved. So like, do you find that it's difficult to kind of keep asking questions and keep hearing these stories? Or is it just that you know that the mission has to be, this is part of it, and there's going to be tears and there's going to be wailing and we just have to do it?
Yeah, the mission is part of it. I think that, you know, when we go into this work and we work with survivors, it's always an option for them. They have the option to share as much truth as they wish. Even during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it wasn't, 100 questions series of interviews. It was, what was life like before residential school? Mm. What do you remember before? What was life like during residential school? And what was life like after post-residential school. So it was really instrumental not only for them to share what they felt was appropriate and what stage they were at in regard to sharing their truths. And during the TRC, we also asked the question about, do you know of any child that went missing or disappeared during Indian residential school? And sometimes they would answer and sometimes not. But these were their peers. And I mean, when I was sitting with a granny one time and I had asked her that about if she knew of any missing children that had gone or died in residential school, she sat with me and she told me the story. She says, we were children. People have to really understand that we were children in those dorms looking after each other. You know, we were 7, 8, 9, sometimes 5. And there was a girl, a young girl who was very fevered and very sick. And so there was nobody there to take care of her and to hold her and to love her and to make sure that she was safe. And so what she did, being a young child and wanting to, she embraced that little girl, and that little girl passed away in her arms. So these are some of the things that were happening. She goes, I knew she was lifeless because I felt her body give way, and then she had wet herself. And that was the end of her life. And she goes, I didn't know how to process that. I didn't understand it, but I was there to take care of her. And thankfully, she held her in her arms as she passed away. So those are the kind of stories that I've heard. I've also heard stories of power, again, in regard to young children. We were out in Ontario one time, and I was sitting, again, with some survivors and women, and they were telling me stories about when they were young children and they wanted to escape the school, is that they took, it was dead of winter, and they went and they took a pair of jeans and extra shirts and they hid them in the woods. And so they wanted to run away to the school, from the school, to get back home. And their home was probably about 20 miles or so. But I think of these young girls being 6, 7, 8 years old, smart enough and wise enough to prepare themselves for that long journey home. And I drove that road from the residential school to their community, and it took us about 20 minutes in a vehicle. So I couldn't imagine these young little girls running through the bush, you know, in order to get home to leave the school. And I thought, wow, that's really powerful. How to be so young and wise and smart and take care of yourself and make it and courageous. And they made it and they got home. I mean, in the end, they had to go back, but they still made it and were that, you know, I just, it brought tears to my eyes because I thought it was very powerful.
So many stories were remembered and saved, and they're going to be in the center forever. But so many were lost. So, like, just thinking about the amount of stories and the amount of people and that cloth that was walked through at the beginning of the event with 2,800 names on it. Can you tell me what that is, what it was, and what the significance is?
Sure. So we, as one of the calls to action, we have created the National Student Memorial Death Register. The memorial cloth is based on that work. And so right now there are 2,800 names on the memorial cloth. There's another, I think, 1,500 in regard to unnamed children that also went missing in the residential schools. So we held ceremony a number of years ago, quite some time ago, and everything that we've done is completed in ceremony. And what the elders suggested that we do is to create a long memorial cloth. It's 50 meters long right now. It's about 5.5 feet wide. And to place every child's name in white. And they wanted to talk about the medicine of that memorial cloth, the powerful imagery, the impacts, because when you think 50 meters, that's half a football field in length, and the work is not done. Our head of archives, Raymond Frogner, has recently conducted research as well. And so we know that that number is going to grow from over 4,000. His work showed that there's another 17,000 notes of death in residential school, and that'll be further distilled down. But it is going to grow. That cloth is going to get longer, and we anticipate over the next decade that more research will clearly understand the full truth and the number of those little ones, those vulnerable children that died in those schools.
Yeah, I think about all the lost stories. I saw one of the, I was just reading as much as I could as the cloth was being brought through the event on last week, and I saw one that said like student 1301, you know what I mean? And it just, it speaks to how important it is to maintain the stories that we do have, that, that did survive. So the center is going to house all the stories, all the transcriptions, all the conversations. Like, tell me about what's, well, after this new building is built, what do you envision for what people will get to experience in the new center?
Okay. So right now, the National Center holds the collection that was gathered during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We have over 7,000 audio and video statements from survivors across the country. So we're still gathering statements. We still understand and know the importance of gathering and hearing the truths of residential school survivors while they're still alive and with us. We continue to lose them every day. We also hold all of the sacred artifacts and items. There's pipes, drums, blankets that were gifted to the TRC that we continue to collect and preserve. People have come in and shared thousands of photographs that were taken during their times in residential school. So some of that work is also in regard to moving forward, understanding who those children were, what school they came from. Sometimes they're anonymous right now, but we know that they really deserve to, you know, have their name mentioned, to have their name shared, to have Canadians all across this land understand the truth of residential school. And I think that when we look at the building, again, which was held first, we had a ceremonial gathering to talk about the visioning. Then we had a ceremonial gathering to bless the land. And I think those are the steps that we go through in regard to the work that we do. And when the NCTR is built, it is a $100 million project, which sounds like an awful lot of money, but now in days of construction, it has, you know, it's very expensive to build something like that. So the University of Manitoba has gifted us the land, which is in a beautiful, beautiful location close to the river. So we will have water access. The NCTR will continue to do research in regard to missing, disappeared residential school children. We will have ceremonial space where Indigenous and non-Indigenous can come together and learn from each other, have educational discussions, hold ceremony, invite our neighbors in, and really repair and provide an understanding as to what the wrongs that happened in the past. And we still continue to live the legacy of moving forward.
Yeah, the way, this isn't going to be once the center's built and job done, right? It's kind of like job starting now in another way, too. Yeah. This is a lifelong, it's going to be a lifelong work for you, right? Why is Winnipeg perfect for this place?
Well, I see Winnipeg as being the heart. In prairie cultures, we call it Turtle Island. So if you take a look at the map and the locations of the land, Winnipeg is right there. And I think that that is a heart. And we have the largest Indigenous population across the country. And we have incredible supporters like the Winnipeg Foundation that have been instrumental and have started the first gift of $5 million. So we have a community here in Winnipeg that has always been supportive of the TRC. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was here just across the street on Main Street. The NCTR is located at the University of Manitoba campus, but I think that there is so much energy, so much willingness to learn from the people that are here that we've worked together for, you know, over a decade now.
And I mean, how have things changed in the last decade as far as like public perception, as far as like knowledge around what the TRC was and what the NCTR is? And like, have you noticed an evolution? Have people been growing and learning, or is there still, has the needle moved at all? Like, how do you feel the last 10 years has gone?
Yeah, so during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they finished their mandate and issued a report. At the time, I had felt that it was instrumental in changing the history and landscape of what happened in regard to Indian residential schools, because we had really listened to survivors across the land, mm-hmm. and they led that report. 2 years later, we were struggling because the NCTR was born out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There was apathy. I don't think that, although the TRC had happened, to them, not everyone, but some, it was just another report. So mm-hmm. what do we do with that? The calls to action were also very slow to implement and are still being implemented. Rye Moran, the former director, was with us for the first 5 years. Then he went home to take care of family. I wasn't sure that I was going to apply for the position when he left, because I seen the toll and the emotional toll that it took on him. And I am really, really love my family. I love spending time with them. And when he left, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could do that job and take on that responsibility. So they did a posting. They didn't find a successful candidate. And then the chair had asked me, and the VP said, you know, Stephanie, you should really consider applying, at least go through the interview process, and that'll be part of the learning. So I was put in front of a very, very large selection committee, 17 plus people. Wow. With administrators, people from all across the land, former commissioners, educators, vice presidents. And then I got through the first round. And then the second stage was that I had to be and sit with the survivor circle. So that was terrifying to me, because I'm intergenerational survivor. I am not a survivor. And I had to really share about what I thought the future was going to be and convince them that, you know, I was the person to take on that responsibility and continue the work that they have done over the years and for decades, and then to move it forward at the NCTR. So I was 3 months into the position. I was selected, and I was said, are you sure? You know, I wasn't convinced myself that I deserved the role. 3 months later, Tecumloops happened on the West Coast, and the revelation of 215 anomalies. And from that point on, it changed. Everything has changed, and I really believe that it's spirit that is guiding that path and helping with that journey, because before then, you know, we had 19 staff and we were struggling every day to find the monies just to keep the lights on at the house and to convince people that the work was important. All of a sudden, not only Canadians but the world was watching. For the next 3 months post Tecumloops, we were doing interviews from around the world. We were, you know, speaking with countries, Germany, Taiwan, Egypt. Like, there are people just reaching out and saying, like, what has happened here? What is the story that, you know, Canada portrays itself as this incredible nation? And then all of a sudden, you know, the revelation happened. And even though there was a full volume during the TRC, it just connected, because people understood it was children, and they were young children, and they had died, whether it was from illness, whether, you know, there was an accident, but people and young ones were not living in those schools. And, you know, they were at home, they came in closely put into dorms, illness was passed freely. Yeah. And then I just always think, I have 5 grand boys myself, and I can't imagine what it would be like to send them off and for them to become ill and no one to take care of them. And I'm also mother to twin daughters, right? And just the repairing of that family unit has helped. I met my birth mother when I was 28 years old. Wow. Because I was taken away. She had gone and run away from residential school. They sent her home. She became pregnant, and then later on, when she was giving birth to me in the Winnipeg hospital here in Winnipeg, she held me once, and then it was taken away. And I never saw her again for 28 years. And then that moment, and when I talk about the wailing, there was this reconnection of family. And, you know, she saw me and she embraced me. And there was this very guttural moan, almost like a mama bear that, you know, Ooh. Just was taking care of her child. And from that point on, I continued the work, and that's really what my motivation is, because I know that it's happened and continues to happen. People talk about, you know, this being history. It's not history. We are living it every single day. You know, as a result of residential schools, you have missing and murdered Indigenous women, you have the prison system, you have child welfare. So the research that needs to happen and the understanding is going to take a long time, because we had 150 years of residential schools. It's going to take that long in order for us to repair what's happened.
Yeah, the remnants are not gone. How do you deal with people who deny the stories and who say, oh, you know, like they downplay it or they disagree, or like there's a surprising, I was at least surprised, amount of that on social media, in the world, in media in general. What are you just exhausted by it? Do you engage it at all? How do you deal with people who seem determined and dedicated to going against this cause?
Yeah, it's frustrating, it's painful, it's hurtful, it's aggravating, and I go through cycles from grief to angry to being emotional. But then I have to remember, for every denier that sends me an email at the office, there's 1,000 people that want the truth to be told. And we work every year with a large number of youth. We've been very successful in our educational programming. So we host 5 days of online content. Wow. And that can be with culture, language, history, survivors' stories, just to show the power of them and who they are, because they are leaders in their community. They are caregivers, they're politicians, they're lawyers. They have really excelled. And I think that's really important for us to share not only the hurt and the pain, but the other side of what that life was post-residential school. So denialism, I have been in every country, I have been in so many communities across this land. No matter where I was, even though the story may not have been the same, the majority were hurtful. The majority of them suffered. My mother-in-law, who also went to residential school, used education. Even though she was taken away from her family, she still maintains her language. Mm. She speaks Anishinaabe. She thought, you know, they tried to destroy me, but I used education as a tool in order to make a better way for my family. She continued her education and is UM alumni and got her PhD in education at 72.
Legend.
So she is a legend. And I think that as a survivor, you know, that's the power, and the power that those children hold, because, you know, there's many, many triggers, but she just forged ahead and took what was meant to destroy her to her advantage, and then has led a long career working with youth in the community, you know, sharing her story and moving forward. And I'm forever grateful for her.
Another powerful tool that I noticed with friends and family members and people that I've hung out with is the power of humor and laughter. And I found that, like, even after going through the worst possible experiences that a human can go through, they're cracking jokes, they're still giggling and laughing, and just maybe just speak to the power of humor and comedy and laughter with some of the survivors who are still able to laugh even after the worst experiences it's imaginable.
You know? Where I saw the power of laughter was during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and still continues today, to the National Center. So some of those survivors were speaking about the most painful, horrific stories of their life, physical, sexual abuse, not being loved, taken from their family. And then I would see them sitting together and they would be howling. And howling laughter is medicine. And every community that I went to, or nation, they were always talking about how that helps with their healing too. Mm. And I think that at the NCTR, no matter where you go in the building, it's good to hear the laughter, because that's really what keeps us going. And you know, in those dark moments they find. And sometimes it could be, you know, a little risque, but I think mm-hmm. that the laughter really helps them. And, you know, those conversation is bringing them together in that joy. And I think that you also seen a little bit of that, too, during the announcement last week, where there were moments of humor and everything doesn't have to be so sterile, right? Though, even though you were seeing so much emotion and tears, that it was almost like a relief that mm-hmm. it's okay to laugh in those kinds of situations and move forward.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful to be a part of that event on Thursday. I felt so grateful to just be even on the periphery of the pipe ceremony, the water ceremony. And I think over the pandemic myself too, I've really realized the value of ceremony in the world. And I kind of didn't really understand the importance of it to human beings in general. But I think the pandemic just kind of helped me understand, like, to gather, to share experiences, to have ceremonies, it's essential. And I think I was just really grateful to be a part of that on Thursday. And maybe you could just expand a little bit more on why it was necessary to have those ceremonies, why it's a part of everything you guys do moving forward.
Yeah. So at the NCTR, we work very closely with elders and residents. One of them, Elder Florence Painter, is a residential school survivor as well as her husband. In Anishinaabe teachings, we follow the spring equinox ceremony, equinox. Lost my, So we follow quarterly ceremonies, and that really keeps us healthy and strong. So we do that in combination with survivors, governing circle, the staff. And what that does is, you know, you talk about wintertime going to rest. Spring is renewal and just refreshing the spirit. And so it was really important to the elders and survivors that everything that we do, and in receiving the gift of $5 million, which was really, really emotional and joyful and heavy at the same time, because it's not really in regard to the money. It's the fact that the Winnipeg Foundation truly believes in the work and believes in the voice of those survivors. And that was really powerful, and that's ceremony in itself. So we held the pipe ceremony, we held the water ceremony. Water is life. We need it to survive, and we acknowledged it. And we also acknowledged the survivors, the Winnipeg Foundation, the University of Manitoba in that circle as coming together in order to move the work and the NCTR building forward. We also shared the memorial cloth, which was very, very emotionally heavy, but it's also for the people that are here today with us to witness and understand. And I think that that's a moving, important fact, again, because you see those children's names walked by. Anyone that's ever had an opportunity to lift those children and carry them into different venues, September 30th, National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. We also bring the cloth to Parliament Hill to remind the government and the churches that, you know, this work is still ongoing. But during the announcement, it was very hard for me to keep it together. I was very emotional being a parent, being a grandmother. And, you know, I wanted to be and share with such clarity, but I was also moved by spirit in that room. And just looking at everyone that attended and came out, there was about 100 people there, and everyone was in tears. And I just felt that pain, the sorrow, the understanding, the clarity, and really the support of everyone that was there, from the Winnipeg Foundation, University of Manitoba, the survivors themselves that guide and lead and directed how that was supposed to happen. So, you know, I cannot say how grateful and enough miigwetches to everyone that was there, because it was really important. And that's part of ceremony. So those that witnessed can now move forward and share that story, share that oral history, and tell others what they experienced and why this is important.
That's my next question. Bearing witness, what does that mean, and why is it important?
Well, I think for me, in my work and my life bearing witness, the very first time that I really understood what happened in residential school was here in Winnipeg, in Manitoba. It was the very first national event of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And, you know, I didn't learn a lot about residential school growing up in the city or understanding, and even being a 60s scoop, you know,
It was just kind of hush-hush? People didn't want to talk about it?
It just wasn't part of the history, and who was writing that history, right? So it was very difficult growing up and understanding, and I didn't learn until I was in college, really, what it was, what it meant, when I started interviewing survivors and hearing about, you know, their life. And I said, okay, well, I got it. So it happened. There's residential schools in Canada. But the very first national event here in Winnipeg, there was 275 survivors that came through the door that week to share their oral histories. And, you know, first we opened the doors and one survivor signed up, then two, then three, then it was 100, then it was 200 and 275. And we were starting at 6 a.m. and ending at midnight the whole time we were there. And I could really, what I saw was survivors coming, sometimes angry, sometimes hurt, sometimes happy. And they wanted to share and preserve their experience and their statements. And so I would see those that were angry, they would go in the door, they would sit down in a setting like this. You know, we would have the audio video equipment. It was their options if they wanted to be recorded visually or not. Somebody that was very mad would come out and you would see a change. You would see their face change. You would see their shoulders that were so tight kind of be loose. And then they would hug and say, thank you. Thank you for listening to me. And bearing witness in this country is so important. And that's for, and why National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, which is also Orange Shirt Day, is really important for others to witness. Because then you get a sense and an understanding of what people went through. And it's a truth.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about it, or mentioned it at least in passing, but there aren't fewer and fewer survivors left. So it feels like it's even more important to get as many stories as we can and record as many things as we can. But, like, you know, we're working against time here, and there's a lot. So do you feel like this sense of impending, we have to do this work now and quick as possible and get as many survivors as we can, because people are getting older, you know, and the time waits for no man. So what are your thoughts on that? And just,
I feel the urgency every single day. We have survivors that we've worked with over the last 10, 15 years that have passed and have moved on to the spirit world. We know that that once large circle is shrinking. We know they are leaving us every single day. And when I think about that knowledge and history and understanding, we have to capture that. We have to make sure that that happens. And we continue to do that work that was started in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And there was work going on decades even before that. So what is important is that our crime is really sacred work. It's a collection of oral histories, of items, the importance that cannot be lost. And the NCTR, which is going to have a brand new building, will house that collection of sacredness. We will have spaces, theaters, learning spaces, even a kitchen where, you know, we hope to have kukums that are teaching and cooking traditional foods and language. And it's going to be built up. There's residential areas, which the University of Manitoba is also developing. So it's going to be, we are the anchor tenant, and it's a beautiful space. And once those doors open, I hope that visitors come and see us every day, because we will be open to share that knowledge with them.
The word I think of is reverence. There's a reverence for their story and a respect and a love for that. We talked about the significance of witnessing things and that Bentwood box. Could you tell me what the Bentwood, what the Bentwood box is and how, what goes inside it and how that all came to be? I thought that was a cool story.
Yeah. So the Bentwood Box was created during the TRC. It was made by artist Luke Marston, who is an incredible carver and took one piece of wood and steamed it and bent it into this beautiful object and carved it, distinct base. There's a story of his grandmother on the front of the box, if you've seen it, and I hope you can have a picture of the box, but it's his grandmother who also attended residential school, and the finger's broken. So he carved her fingers, which was broken, which happened in residential school. So you also see that on the front of the box, and that's his grandmother's image, which I thought is very beautiful and powerful. And that's also part of that sacredness that we hold, because he's also put it into the artistic impression of what this box meant for truth and reconciliation was meant to be. So all across the country, there were many, many different people. Could have been institution, church, the Royal Winnipeg Ballet put little tiny ballet slippers into that box as a memory that these were children. And you know that anybody could be a dancer. And we hold on to that culture and importance of the art that we hold and share. So there were people from all over that placed items and thoughts of what reconciliation could be moving forward in this country. And we continue to care and respect for the box. It is medicine. The artist speaks very highly that it is alive. There's an energy attached to the Bentwood box. And whatever you carry in the spirit and place of that box is what it is taking in. So we also make sure that, and I refer to it as she, but that protected, cared for, we smudge, we cleanse her, take her out to these gatherings because she is alive. And I think for those that witness the Bentwood box, they can feel that and see that. We are at gatherings where survivors come up because it truly belongs to them and they want photos with the box, but there's just good energy there because that really is, I guess you could say, the space that keeps us going.
It's a representation, it's a physical manifestation of all the stories. Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't know about that, about the grandma, that those faces are, they're very like distinct, very like you can't look away almost, or I don't know what the word is, but
no,
really
you know,
powerful.
You can walk around the box and you can take a look and you see, but for every single face, there is a teaching attached to the box from Luke and his perspective. And that's also something that his oral history as to how that was created and preserved also sits with the NCTR, because he came and visited and did an teaching to us to just really clearly understand what it's meant and how it was meant to be cared for.
Powerful. We talked a little bit before we started recording about the moment that I'm going to remember from the event on Thursday for the rest of my life. There was, I think he was the tallest guy in the whole room. What was the gentleman's?
Eugene Arcand.
One of the survivors went up, and all the survivors, not all, but many survivors were coming up and sharing their story and just talking about the importance of the NCTR to them and the whole process and everything. And he got a little choked up, and then like five or six grandmas, cuckums came behind him and put their hand on his back, and I just lost it there. Anything with grandmas makes me think of my grandma, who I miss, Vera, every day. And I just wanted to ask you, what is the importance of like grandmas to the movement?
Oh.
Sorry.
That's okay. Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful moment.
Oh, I'll never forget it.
Like, I know.
Because he's just like this rough and tumble looking cowboy, you know. And
he's Eugene Arcand is amazing. He is incredible. He played sports. Sports kept him alive, and he survived through that action in residential school. He talks about, you know, getting better food because they were on the road. Mm. So he is this kind of very, very strong and hardy survivor that I have known for the last, gosh, it's going on 14 years now. The time flies by. And yeah. You know, I've seen him in many, many situations. So what people have to recognize, and when you see, you know, he was very emotional. It was a very powerful day. And those grandmas coming up, the matriarchs of our nations and our society that lived that, were coming to stand with him and to show their strength and power, that they support him and they're behind him. And they really just being there is to lift up and give him that strength. And what a beautiful moment. And every time that that happens, and I'm talking about it now and I can feel the chills and the strength of that. And, you know, that's how we work. That's how the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation continues to work. We're supported both by grandmas and grandpas, and they lead and guide us. I could not do this work alone. Survivors can't do the work alone. The staff can't do the work alone. So they come and stand in unity with us while they're still here and show that support. And that really is crucial. And it's the love that they still have to give, even though as children they weren't loved.
It's what it's all about by the sounds of it. You know, it seems as though certain jobs like yours and the highs are the highest you could possibly get and the lows are the lowest you can possibly get. How do you stay mentally healthy and like how do you self-care going through the roller coaster of emotions for the last probably 30 years? You know, like how do you stay good?
How do I stay good? I have amazing elders and grandmothers that coach, guide, sit with me, talk about ceremony, give their teachings. I'm a parent and a grandmother, and the fact that I was a 60 scoop survivor and I now have my family unit that are very close, that I see them 3 or 4 times a week, is really what gives me the energy, because we come together and we cook and we share. And just that, you know, my grandchildren are 8, 8, 9, 3, and 6 months.
All so boys.
All boys. All boys. And it's like a little bit of house chaos, but what good energy, because there is no better energy in knowing that my children are safe and sound right now, and because many of our people have never had that option. And that's just one way as to protect and to continue to move forward and to keep the family unit together when we didn't have that choice. And still today, some people don't have that choice. But that energy and self-care is really important. And I love a good swim as well. Nice. And water is very healing to me. And that's how I choose to take the time and swim with my grandchildren. And yeah,
I was a lifeguard for a few years. So same.
I love it. I love it. I almost made lifeguard, but you know,
it's a tough gig. Or it was back then. So what's next for the center, for you? What's on the horizon that you're most looking forward to? Obviously, raise a little bit more money is going to be part of the work moving forward. But like, what are you most looking forward to when it comes to the NCTR in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so we are soon going to be going into the design phase of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. We have completed the community engagement across the country. We've done the visioning with the Survivor Circle. The next phase that's really I am looking forward to is what the architects will come up based on that vision and the design. I'm really looking forward to see what that beauty will be, because it has to be First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. And survivors really asked for that to be seen, whether it's in the landscapes, the building design, the grounds, a space for, you know, the memorial cloth to be really respected and so that people can come and witness it. I think that is the number one focus, to see that as the next phase in design. And then I hope to break ground while the beautiful grandmas and grandpas are still with us in order to see that, because I really do believe that those that have worked closely with us need to see that come to fruition. And that is really what the urgency is, because they need to see their truths is coming in reconciliation. And we're not there yet. We still have a long way to go. But that's number one. We will continue to educate Canadians across this country. I had mentioned earlier in some of the work that we do with the broadcast and online content, you know, we had started out with one broadcaster before Tecumloops happened and the 215 children. Now we're up to 18 broadcasters. Wow. Sharing the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation and Orange Shirt Day across the land. So we reach over a million people every year, and that's awesome. Really important and instrumental. So I see that again as one of our priorities. And then just to work with the survivors and those that are willing to share in communities to help find their missing and disappeared children. That research is ongoing, and I, in the hopes and dreams of survivors, and for me, if we can just bring those one or two or three children home, put their names together, understand that narrative, how they died, what life was like for them, so that we can share that respectfully with their families, for them to understand what happened to their child that went missing, so they can start that healing process. Because can you imagine in this day and age not knowing to date where your child went, how they died, where they were buried? And I've looked in the archive, and the archive is very painful as well, because you see it there in the records, and this speaks to the denialism, is that, you know, you have church administrators arguing with federal government.
Whose responsibility
is this? And the letters are like, They're really sad, because, you know, over a few dollars, they would argue about it. It's not worth the expense to send that child home. So they were buried in paupers' graves. And it's there in a typed letter. I've seen letters from parents saying, in cursive writing, how could you have buried my child without telling me? Do you know what this does to a man? And you see that, and you witness that, and you understand that. And that's what has to be told to all Canadians. They have to see that, because paired with the statements and the oral histories of survivors, and that black and white record has to be revealed.
That's the context. That's the context. And you can hear 215, you can hear 700, numbers or whatever they are, but the context of the specifics and the stories and the individuals, that's the power.
You see it, and you know, some of those letters are very derogatory, and that's what needs to be shown to fight denialism.
100%. Thank you for your time with us. At the end of the podcast, we do a segment called Just Because. It's about the causes you care about and the effect that it has in your life. That's the show, Because and Effect. Want to go through those seven questions with us, rapid fire?
Sure.
Or, I mean, take as much time as you want. It doesn't have to be rapid fire. Question one, what is the first cause you ever remember caring about?
The first cause I ever remember caring about is water. Mm-hmm. I was in grade 8, and I remember I did a science project called Phosphates and Water Pollution.
Wow.
And that was decades ago, before water was even being heavily polluted. It was on the scale. But I always knew that water being life and a care for it, and I love swimming in it, it always healed me. That was the very first cause that I thought of. And I remember, you know, being in that little science fair and having my little poster board. My grandpa put it together. He made a wood board for me, and I had my little,
it folded out.
It was high end, I tell you. So moved forward and didn't get the gold, but I did get an honorable mention. And that was the very first cause, because we all need life to live. And that is really important, and still does, because now it's in ceremony as well. And I even better understand the greatness of protecting that life source.
Yeah, hopefully the rest of Canada and the world can get behind that as well too, because we don't treat our water nice enough. That's in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
Question two, if money and politics and logistics were no issue at all, you could just snap your fingers and something would happen, what would you do in support of your current cause? If all those barriers were removed, what would you do?
I would give every single survivor their biggest wish for them, whether it was food security, bringing their family home, knowing where their loved ones are, you know, really led by them and doing what they wanted with what was available. And that, if the option, dream big.
That really came through on Thursday, that it was all survivor driven, survivor led. You know, that it was there stories. It was their project. You really gave them a lot of credit, and I think it's a beautiful thing to continue to do so. Like, it's
We exist. The NCTR exists because of survivors. There is no other way, and anyone that doesn't know that really needs to know that and understand that.
And read their stories. Come to the center.
Come to the center. Come to the NCTR.
Question three, what's the biggest misunderstanding or the biggest stigma that you deal with?
The biggest misunderstanding.
We talked a little bit about stigma, but what else is there?
Well, I think for me, the biggest stigma, I guess for me, being an Indigenous woman in Canada, living in the city of Winnipeg, is that sometimes others will have a certain perception or understanding or thought about who I am as an individual.
Assumptions, presumptions.
A lot of assumptions, a lot of presumptions. You know, I walk into the grocery store, I walk into shop. It doesn't matter where I am in life, I get followed. And that's probably happens about 80% of the time. So, you know, it's very difficult, and some days I'm just too exhausted to address it, but other days I tackle it head on, and it can be really shocking that someone will take that power back from that, you know, racist or stereotypical thought or idea about being an Indigenous woman in this city. It happens elsewhere, and it will continue to happen. And I hope that in the work that the NCTR does through education, that it changes not only for me, but everyone that has ever faced that and that difficulty in navigating just daily life.
I've had conversations of like the burden of education is put again on Indigenous people. And is that, I understand when some folks are like, it's not our job to do this. There's enough information out there. You can educate yourselves. But also it seems as though education is something that you're passionate about and wanting to play a part in. So like, how is that balanced?
How's it balanced? I think everyone that, you know, there is a balance. We provide the resources and the context. And I think that every individual in this country has a responsibility to take that information, listen to the survivors' history and stories, and carry that forward. And we aren't the only ones doing it. It does get tiring, but I can tell you in the last few years, there have been so many allies, so many supporters that really understood through the children's spirit as to what has happened in this country. And, you know, we're not doing it alone anymore. And that's the greatness of this work, because it is very hopeful. And I do see change, and I will continue to see change. And the survivors that are with us right now will continue to lead that change. And we are just the foundation to do that work for them.
I tend to be a little impatient when it comes to just change not happening fast enough. But this really feels like a culmination. It really feels like an actual something that is being built and created and moved along, that like there is progress being made. And sometimes it feels like two steps forward, one step back. But this really feels like a giant leap forward. And yeah,
it is a giant leap forward. I've never built a building before, but I mean, I thought it was very quick and short, but there is a process and there is a series of elements that needs to happen. Not only the fundraising and the support from community, but also just making sure that everyone sees the NCTR as an international learning lodge, and that we are all part of it, Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. And we can share and we can educate together, and we can amplify the survivors' truths, and we can move forward together in this country, because none of us are going anywhere and we have to work together.
Beautiful. Question four, what's a recent victory in your life, either personally or professionally, that you can share with us? That's something that you're like, ooh, I got a dub.
Victory keepers. Yeah.
I mean, obviously Thursday was a pretty good day. The event.
Yes. So I would say that the support of the Winnipeg Foundation is indeed a victory. We have a long way to go. Like, I was thinking about it, and I really honestly believe the most moving part of that was that after, you know, the decade of work, that somebody listened to the voice of the survivors, And they supported that. So the board, you know, agreed to move this forward. And that was a victory in a sense. But we still got a long way to go through the battle and claim more victory because it's still fresh.
Beautifully said. Question five, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given? Put you on the spot.
Yeah, no. The best piece of advice, I think, was go home. Tell those that are near and close to you that you love them. It's a simple act, but that is also healing. And you never know what happens because loss comes quick. And I just want everyone, my family, the survivors, the people that work with us and support us, that I love them. Mm. My glitch.
That was one of the moments at the event too. I can't remember. One of the survivors said he lost his wife kind of recently and said, go home and tell the people you love that you love them. And I called my mom on my way home from the event. I was just like, I love you. Anyways.
Power yeah. In those words.
100%. Such a good, I just feel so grateful that I was even get to be in the room. I feel kind of like Forrest Gump, that I just get to be in these rooms where these magical moments are happening. And I'm just like, happy to be there. Anyways,
it's power.
For sure. Question six, what advice would you give to your 10-year-old self if you could speak with her?
I would say, don't let the racism get you down, that you love yourself, that even though you think right now that you don't mean a lot, that you may be meaningless at this point in time in your life, Creator has a path for you, and the journey will be powerful, the journey will be strong, and that there's no better person to do it than you.
Perfect. Beautiful. Last question. Thanks again for your time. Thank you for all your work. Thanks for answering all these questions and just being with us today. Stephanie Scott, what do you want to be remembered for?
What do I want to be remembered for? That I was a good mother, a good sister, a good granny, and that, you know, I did the work on behalf of my nation to make a better life for each and every one of us.
Beautiful. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.